today on Against the Grain. What can outsiders, what can troublemaking nonconformists offer to revolutionary movements? In the British Marxist T.A. Jackson, Philip Bounds sees both a mischievous contrarian and an effective radical. I'm C.S., the historian and critic. Philip Bounds talks about Jackson's life and also Jackson's writings on Dickens and Shakespeare, coming right up. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. What role does loyalty play in radical political formations? The answer would be a lot. Group cohesion and the ability to take concerted action are jeopardized when people go this way and that, when participants don't throw themselves behind at least the basic agenda of the party or organization. In many Marxist groupings, loyalty and respect for party leadership have been viewed as paramount. But in the view of Philip Bounds, nonconformity and eccentricity can also matter a lot, and it certainly did in the case of, in the person of, T.A. Jackson. Jackson was a British socialist, a nonconformist, and a stubbornly independent thinker who, nevertheless, according to Bounds, was enormously effective in pushing for radical social change. Jackson wrote a memoir, published 2 years before his death in 1955, which, according to Bounds, evokes what might be called the outsider's road to socialism. T.A. Jackson also wrote about writers like Charles Dickens and Shakespeare, both about what he saw as their political views and about how those views found expression in their literary works. Philip Bounds, an historian and critic who has published widely on the intellectual history of the British left, wrote an article about T.A. Jackson that appears in the current issue of the journal Socialism and Democracy. When Philip joined me from the UK, I asked what motivated him to research and write the article.
Well, I think T.A. Jackson is an underrepresented figure in communist historiography. Not many people have written about him. Those that have written about him in very little detail. And he seems to me to be a very important figure in the history of the world communist movement for a number of reasons. Probably the most important reason is that he is one of the most important examples of the kind of self-taught working class intellectuals who flourished in the world communist movement in its heyday. The world communist movement back in the 20s and the 30s and the 40s was renowned for encouraging men and women who may not have had much in the way of formal education to master intellectual disciplines like history, philosophy, science, and so on. And in the British context, I think T.A. Jackson is the most distinguished example of that species of self-taught working class intellectual. Another reason I think he's quite important is that his personality and his outlook in some respects set him apart from his fellow communists. The world communist movement in Jackson's day was in some respects quite a dour phenomenon. The world communist movement put a premium on things like earnestness, loyalty, respect for leaders, and things like that. And the point about T.A. Jackson was that he wasn't very good at things like earnestness and loyalty and respect for leaders. Although he was loyal to the British Communist Party, nevertheless, he had a very skeptical and mischievous and questioning personality. He wasn't the sort of person who would allow the leadership of the British Communist Party to get away with things that he disagreed with. And he did have this kind of mischievous attitude to politics, which makes him a very attractive figure, I think, in retrospect. And one of the things I argue in my article about him is that this questioning, mischievous, skeptical perspective grew out of the fact that he was something of an outsider. Jackson was one of those people who never really fits in any given milieu. And I think his skepticism, his willingness to criticize the leadership of the Communist Party, his irreverence towards the kind of encrusted rituals of the world communist movement was an expression in part of the fact that he didn't fit in and was incapable of the kind of absolute loyalty and leader worship which at times tended to disfigure the world communist movement in the age of Stalin.
So T.A. Jackson, he was born in London in 1879. Do you have any sense of what might have given him a sense of not belonging or not fitting in early in life?
Yes. I mean, he was born, as you say, in 1879 in Clerkenwell in London. He was born into a working class family, but a skilled working class family. His father was a compositor at a local printworks. Some of his relatives were blacksmiths and carpenters and things like that. So there was a respect for skill in the Jackson family. But Jackson wasn't an altogether typical working class child. He was, as you say, an outsider from early on. And there were a couple of things, I think, which accounted for this. The first was a physical reason. Jackson was very short-sighted. He was born astigmatic. His eyesight was very poor. And what that meant was that he wasn't able to participate in the games that his childhood friends played in the streets around his home as fully as he would have wished. And even when he did get a pair of glasses, which enabled him to see better than before, even then he was somewhat set apart from his contemporaries because his parents made it clear to him that they couldn't afford to replace the glasses if they were broken. So Jackson was a slightly solitary figure on those grounds. But another reason, I think, for being set slightly apart from his contemporaries was that he very early on acquired a passion for reading and knowledge and history. His father was a radical trade unionist who was very sympathetic to the movement for Irish independence. And early on, he would read to T.A. Jackson from history books and story books of other kinds. And Jackson acquired a very deep love of narrative and of history at an early age. And to a certain extent, that set him apart from his contemporaries.
What kind of education or schooling did Jackson receive as a child?
He received very limited education, like so many of the people who joined the World Communist Movement in the 20s and 30s and became self-educated. Jackson was educated formally only for a very short period. He was educated at the Duncombe Road School in London between 1886 and 1893. So he was about 13 when he left school. Like most other working class children of the time, he left school and went out into the world of work.
And I want to talk more about T.A. Jackson's life, including his teenage years, in the context of his memoir. He wrote a memoir. It's entitled Solo Trumpet. It was published in 1953. Now, in your essay, you differentiate Jackson's memoir from other autobiographies written by British radicals. So what do those autobiographies tend to portray in terms of their tone and the kind of person portrayed?
As I said earlier, Jackson was an outsider. And I think what distinguished his memoir, Solo Trumpet, from that of many other communist memoirs is that it is preoccupied precisely with the way in which outsiders become committed to the left and the role which outsiders can play in the left. And it's that, I think, more than anything else, which distinguishes Jackson's book from that of many other communist autobiographies. Many communist autobiographies produced by people of Jackson's generation were studies in respectability. That is to say, although their authors portray themselves as implacable opponents of capitalist society, nonetheless, they also emphasize their own respectability. And often what happens is that they portray their conversion to the politics of the left as a byproduct of the fact that their inherent goodness, their inherent moral concerns, their inherent respectability is somehow frustrated by the nature of capitalist society. One of the classic instances of this is the first volume of William Gallagher's memoirs, a book called Revolt on the Clyde, which came out in the 1930s. Gallagher was a Scotsman who was a communist MP in Britain between 1935 and 1950. And what's interesting about the early parts of Gallagher's book is is the fact that he gives the impression that his early employers in Scotland didn't live up to his own high moral standards. He writes at length about working for an exploitative grocer in Scotland who pays him very little and overworks him and so on. And the impression one gets is that an almost saintly Gallagher is appalled by the immorality of his early employers and becomes a convert to the politics of the left on those grounds.
That's Philip Bounds. He's an historian, journalist, and critic, and we are talking about an article he contributed to the journal Socialism and Democracy, the article being about the British communist thinker, writer, and agitator T.A. Jackson. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. So does Jackson, in his memoir, does he likewise depict himself as a conscientious worker whose idealism is shattered by exploitative employers?
No, not really. This is precisely what Jackson doesn't do, and it's what makes Solo Trumpet such a refreshing piece of work. Jackson left school, as I said, at 13, and he went to work then in a print shop near Chancery Lane in London, and he was apprenticed as a print worker for 7 or 8 years until the age of 21. And the section of Solo Trumpet which deals with that period of Jackson's life makes it clear that he was not at all a committed or ideal employee. On the contrary, the impression Jackson conveys in that section of the book is that he was, in a sense, the employee from hell. He was someone who didn't want to go to work, wanted to spend his time reading, was horrified by the thought that he would have to spend the best years of his life toiling away for many hours a day in a print shop. And so when he writes about his early experiences of work, what he is writing about, in a sense, is his own incapacity to settle down to the natural discipline of the workplace. There are some very entertaining passages in the book where he talks about simply leaving the print shop and walking around London and being enchanted by the streets near the print shop where he worked and their aesthetic associations and their historical associations and so on. There are other passages where he talks about climbing through the window of the print shop onto the roof of the building and taking out a book and spending hours reading it when he should have been engaged in his print work and so on. So the impression he conveys is not of a highly respectable young man whose idealism is stymied by the capitalist system, but of a slightly disreputable, though well-meaning and compassionate young man who acquires a dislike of capitalism precisely because it is making too many demands upon him and precisely because it is preventing him doing the things he loves, reading, walking around, exploring the historic byways of London and so on.
So after he finishes his apprenticeship, I imagine he looks for employment, for kind of permanent employment in the printing business. How did that search go?
Well, it went very badly. He finished his apprenticeship at the age of 21 in about 1900. And when he went to try and find work, he found that he had been blacklisted throughout the trade. No one wanted to employ him because he had a very bad reputation. And he had a very bad reputation on the one hand because he had been such an unreliable apprentice, because he hadn't been able to adapt himself to the disciplines of the workplace. But he was also blacklisted because by this time he had become a convert to the politics of the revolutionary left. He'd been something of a militant trade unionist while he had been an apprentice in the print works. And then in 1898, he had read the book Merry England by the great English socialist propagandist Robert Blatchford. And he had been converted to socialism as a result of reading that book. So by the time he finished his apprenticeship, he was known quite widely in London as a kind of socialist troublemaker, a militant trade unionist, a propagandist for socialism. And for that reason, he found that at the age of 21, in effect, his career in printing had come to an end.
Tell me about the political groupings he moved into and apparently out of. And let's start in the first decade of the 20th century. What did he join? What did he participate and get involved in? And what was the end result?
Jackson took a long time to settle down in the revolutionary left in Britain. Although when the Communist Party was founded in 1920, he remained in it until the end of his life. He jumped from group to group in the first 20 years or so of his membership of the revolutionary left. When he was a young man, the leading Marxist organization in Britain was the Social Democratic Federation, the SDF, which had been founded in 1881 by H.M. Hindman, who was probably Britain's first native significant Marxist propagandist. And there was always a certain amount of tension between Hindman and the rank and file of the SDF. And early in the 20th century, Jackson was caught up in a rebellion against H.M. Hindman and the leadership of the SDF. Some people call it the impossibilist revolt, because the young men, and they were primarily young men, who opposed Hindman felt that Hindman was putting too much emphasis on the need for reforms and insufficient emphasis on the need for the revolutionary overthrow of capitalism. These were young men who believed that the more that a Marxist party emphasized immediate reforms, the less likely it would be to focus people's minds on the need to overthrow the capitalist system and establish a socialist alternative. So these impossibilists, as they were called, launched a rebellion against the leadership of the SDF in the early 20th century. And that led in 1904 to a split in the SDF. And in fact, two new parties were founded at about that time. One was the Socialist Labour Party, the SLP. And that was a party which Jackson was to join much, much later on. But the party which Jackson became a founder member of in 1904 was called the Socialist Party of Great Britain, the SPGB. And the SPGB was committed to the kind of anti-reformist line which I've just mentioned. They believed that any campaigning for reforms in capitalist society represented a betrayal of the socialist cause. So for some time, Jackson was a leading member of the Socialist Party of Great Britain, and it was about this time in his life that he began becoming a really good public speaker. He used to speak on Socialist Party of Great Britain platforms, open-air platforms in parks and city squares and so on.
You write that most communist autobiographers portray their entry into the left in rapturously positive terms, seeing it as the gateway to a life of selfless, satisfying, and often heroic activism. Did Jackson portray his conversion to socialism in this way?
No, he didn't. I mean, he made it clear that his conversion to socialism and his entry into the world of the left sects represented an absolute climacteric in his life, an important moment in his life. But the other thing he conveys in Solo Trumpet is a sense of exasperation with the internal culture of those parties and of what he obviously regards as the ineptitude of the leadership.
Did he have any ill feelings toward his comrades on the Marxist left as far as what they might not have provided him with, what they didn't do for his intellectual and political development?
To a certain extent, yes. I think one of the problems Jackson had with his comrades in these early socialist parties in the first two decades of the 20th century was a sense that they didn't provide him with the intellectual stimulation he craved. Although we think of Marxist parties as being very bookish, and although we think of Marxist parties as making immense intellectual demands on their members, what Jackson found in the first decade or so of the 20th century was that insufficient intellectual demands were being made on him. He wasn't being challenged to widen his area of knowledge and to deepen his knowledge of the areas he was interested in. So there is a sense in which Jackson was disaffected with the leadership of the Marxist parties for that reason. The other reason I think he was a bit disaffected with some of those Marxist parties was he felt that there was a kind of demand for deference on the part of the leadership and a contempt for the more eccentric members of the movement, which he found very hard to deal with. He's particularly critical, as so many British Marxists were, of H.M. Hindman, the founder and leader of the Social Democratic Federation, because he regarded Heinemann as a rather contemptuous, autocratic figure who looked down not simply on members of his own party, but on working people as a whole. And he felt that the socialist cause was being held back by that kind of autocratic, slightly snobbish attitude. And he celebrated those members of the socialist movement like himself who behaved very, very irreverently towards leaders like Heinemann. There's quite an amusing anecdote in Solo Trumpet about an SPGB member called Moses Beritz. And Beritz on one occasion was denied access to an SDF meeting in Salford where H.M. Heinemann was speaking. He was thrown out. He was told that he was a troublemaker and that he wasn't welcome in the hall. So what Beritz did was to climb onto the roof of the hall, produce a flute from his jacket pocket, and blow some sort of severely atonal obligatos down the ventilated shaft. So H.M. Heinemann, who was on the platform at the time, found himself completely drowned out by this kind of Schoenberg-like assault that Beritz was launching upon him. And the result was that Beritz was persuaded to climb down from the roof and offered a place in the front row of the meeting. So Jackson had great respect for kind of political pranksters like that, who were able to puncture the pomposity of leaders like Heinemann without being ill-natured about it.
Philip Bounds joins us on Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. Philip is an historian, an author, and a critic. He's worked as a lecturer at a number of universities. His books include Orwell and Marxism and British Communism and the Politics of Literature, 1928 to 1939. He's also co-editor of the volume British Marxism and Cultural Studies. And we are talking about a fair amount of research that Philip has done into the life and work of the British communist thinker, writer, and agitator T.A. Jackson, who was born in 1879 and died in 1955. And as Philip has told you, what interests him in Jackson, among other things, is Jackson's outsider status, his fascination with marginality. And Philip Bounds writes that Jackson's memoir called Solo Trumpet evokes, quote, what might be called the outsider's road to socialism. You mentioned that Jackson became an orator, a paid orator, and he went around England giving talks. What kinds of topics did he address in his public presentations?
His range of topics was extraordinarily wide. I mean, having been drummed out of the printing industry at the age of 21, Jackson had to find some way of making a living. And incredible as it may seem to us, what he did was to become a kind of itinerant orator. In those days in Britain, there was a very rich outdoor culture of political oratory. Political orators would stand on soapboxes in parks and on street corners and in city squares, and they would orate, sometimes at great length, and often to very large audiences. His range of topics was extraordinarily wide. He spoke about politics, about economics, about international affairs, about literature, and a variety of other topics. But one of the topics he was particularly enthusiastic about in those early years of itinerant oratory was religion. Jackson, at this stage in his life, was an absolutely militant atheist. He hated religion and believed that a belief in God or any other supernatural force was an inherently reactionary thing which would prevent working people from changing society and establishing a new socialist order. So he propagandized incessantly against religion. And one of the things he did was to emulate the tactic of the great 19th century British radical Richard Carlyle. Because what Richard Carlyle had done had been to incite the authorities into prosecuting him. He would go on and on issuing blasphemous, provocative material in the hope that he would be arrested and in the hope that he would therefore bring the law into disrepute. You know, his theory was that the more someone was arrested for giving speeches or writing pamphlets, the more ridiculous the repressive censorship laws that existed in Britain would look. And Jackson repeated that tactic himself when he became a street corner orator. He gave innumerable speeches about religion. He always took care to denounce religion in the strongest possible terms. And there was a period when he found himself being arrested time and time again. And for him, that was a triumph, because although it was a great inconvenience for him, and although he found himself in court and obliged to pay fines time and time again, he felt that he was making a contribution to bringing Britain's censorship laws into disrepute. And indeed, after a while, the police suddenly stopped attending his meetings and stopped arresting him, because they realized that they were making themselves look ridiculous rather than discrediting his socialist oratory.
And this breaking of the law, breaking laws that Jackson and maybe many other radicals viewed as unjust, how important did Jackson see that tactic or strategy in the effort to reach the goal of a more just society and institute a more radical form of politics?
Well, in the early stages of his career on the left, not so much later, but in the first sort of 10 or 20 years of the 20th century, Jackson belonged to a group of people who almost thought that it was a principle that one should break the law as frequently as possible. There was a group of people in the SBGB in particular who specialized in techniques for ripping off restaurant owners and so on. They committed crimes incessantly simply because of economic necessity. They simply wouldn't have been able to eat and clothe themselves unless they resorted to theft and petty larceny and all the rest of it. But they justified their criminal or semi-criminal tendencies on the grounds that if the laws in a capitalist society, crudely speaking, exist in order to prop up the capitalist order, then one of the best ways in which a revolutionary can hone his opposition to capitalism is to break its laws as frequently as possible. So these were kind of cheerful socialist criminals, ripping people off, committing all manner of ingenious frauds in order, in part, to demonstrate their hostility to the society they wish to overthrow.
What did T.A. Jackson, what did he think of factionalism and sectarianism on the left? And what did he do to try to address it?
That's quite a complex question, because on the one hand, Jackson was himself an enthusiastic factionalist. As I've already said, he was an early member of the SDF, soon became exasperated with its leadership, and then became involved in a group of rebels within the SDF who ended up breaking away and joining the SPGB. So throughout his
career...
And
the SPGB, again, is the Socialist Party of Great Britain. And what is the SPF again?
Yeah, the SDF, the Social Democratic Federation. So as I say, Jackson was himself a factionist at certain points in his career. And throughout his career, he always shied away from the idea that one should simply respect the line that the leadership of a revolutionary party took and that one shouldn't question it. He always retained a deeply questioning and in some cases cynical perspective on his leaders. So on the one hand, Jackson was by no means alien to the world of socialist factionalism. On the other hand, he did feel that he, as a sort of outsider in the movement, had a role to play in reconciling factions, because he never felt that he fitted in with any given faction, because he always felt a bit distant from all the different trends in the socialist movement. Jackson believed that he could mediate between the different factions. He could go back and forth between factions in the labor movement and persuade them to cooperate with each other. And Solo Trumpet, his memoir, culminates with the foundation of the Communist Party of Great Britain, the CPGB, in 1920. And one of the things Jackson portrays himself as doing in the closing stages of the text is mediating between the various groups which came together to found the Communist Party, trying to point out areas of commonality between them, trying to build up trust between people in different factions who up until that point hadn't trusted each other at all. So this is a very interesting example, I think, of Jackson's analysis of the role of the outsider in politics. One of the roles is precisely to stand apart from all the existing factions and to mediate between them in such a way as to give rise to a modicum of political unity.
His name is Philip Bounds. He is an historian and a critic, and we are talking about an article he wrote about the really interesting activist and author and thinker named T.A. Jackson, a British communist And you can find that in the July 2017 issue of the journal Socialism and Democracy. We'll take a short break and speak more with Philip about Mr. Jackson. Please stay with us. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm C.S. Song. Philip Bounds, he holds a PhD in politics from the University of Wales. He's published widely on the intellectual history of the British left. And one man who has intrigued him and now intrigues me is a British communist named T.A. Jackson, who died in 1955. So, Philip, in this article you wrote about T.A. Jackson in the journal Socialism and Democracy, you don't just focus on Jackson's memoir, his autobiography entitled Solo Trump, but you also look to T.A. Jackson's critical writings on authors like Dickens and Shakespeare. And you write that Jackson's work in this area of literary criticism needs to be seen in the context of an effort to excavate a history, specifically the history of the English radical tradition. Why might that have been important? Why was that important to radicals like T.A. Jackson?
Well, from 1935 on, the interest in excavating the radical traditions of different countries was actually communist policy. It was part of the so-called Popular Front policy that the Communist International adopted in 1935. The Popular Front policy, as is well known, was essentially an anti-fascist policy. Hitler had come to power in Germany in 1933. It was now becoming clear that fascism posed a threat to the European democracies and indeed to the rest of the world. And so the Communist Party adopted the Popular Front policy. Its essence was the belief that in order to defeat fascism, communists had to promote the broadest possible anti-fascist alliance between communists, socialists, but also between liberals and even progressive conservatives. There was this emphasis on the broadest possible anti-fascist alliance to save the world from the menace of Hitlerism and fascism more generally. And the Popular Front policy had a very important cultural dimension to it, which was involved with the excavation of radical traditions, because at the 1935 Congress of the Communist International held in Moscow, the Communist International's president, Georgi Dimitriev, argued that one of the reasons fascists had been successful in various parts of the world was that they had posed as the inheritors of their respective national traditions. So someone like Mussolini in Italy had argued that his movement was carrying forward the distinctive values of the Italian independence movement of the 19th century. In an American context, American fascists were arguing that they were the natural inheritors of the rebel forces in the War of Independence. So fascists had been successful in part by appealing to history and by claiming that they were carrying forward the values of the countries to which they belonged. And Dimitriev's argument was that there has to be a kind of parallel project from the left. If communists are to fight back against fascists, they have to launch their own bid to portray themselves as the culminating points of their respective national traditions. So what Dimitriev urged communists to do was to write about, popularize the history of what you might call plebeian populist movements in their own countries. They wanted to demonstrate to people that in every country of the world, there were rich traditions of popular revolt by peasants, by working people and so on, against the elite. But another thing he wanted them to do was to point out that there was a rich literary and artistic tradition which expressed radical sentiments, which sided with the people against the elite, and which in many respects foreshadowed the values of the communist movement. And Dmitriev's appeal had an extraordinary effect in Britain, where for the rest of the 30s, a very large and important body of work was produced on what, as you said, was called the English radical tradition. Actually, of course, communists were interested in the Welsh, Scottish and Irish radical traditions as well. But in those days, England was seen as something which kind of stood in for the rest of the British Isles. So you had books like A.L. Morton's A People's History of England, which told the history of England from the perspective of working class revolt and was an absolutely pioneering work of Marxist history. You had books by Jack Lindsay, which tried to elaborate a total theory of culture. But you also had a lot of books and essays on individual writers like William Langland, John Bunyan, Jonathan Swift, William Blake, Charles Dickens, and so on. And I think it's against that background that Jackson's book on Dickens has to be seen. Jackson published a book in 1937 called Charles Dickens, The Progress of a Radical. And that was one of the three or four most distinguished pieces of work produced in response to Dmitriev's call for an investigation of the history of English radicalism.
And Jackson's book on Charles Dickens, it does at least two things. It looks at what Dickens expressed or conveyed in his novels, and it also looked at who Dickens was as a person, what his political sentiments were, what his political opinions were. Let's start with the way Dickens portrayed people in his novels. How did Jackson think Dickens wrote that reflected well or badly on, for example, capitalism?
Jackson didn't believe that Dickens was a communist, but he did believe that Dickens had a powerful understanding of the problems of capitalism. And in particular, he argued that Dickens's work is dominated by a kind of cultural critique of capitalism. Time and again in Dickens's work, Jackson argues, what we find is the idea that capitalism cripples people emotionally and subjectively, that people live less rich lives than they might because of the cultural imperatives of the capitalist system. And what he meant, I think, was essentially this. Dickens believed, according to Jackson, that capitalism is a system which promotes the idea of self-denial. Because employers have to drive down wages in order to accumulate capital in order to compete on the market, capitalism necessarily emphasizes the idea that we should deny ourselves, that we should lead ascetic, self-denying lives. And Dickens's insight, along with many other cultural critics of the 19th century, was that this emphasis on material self-denial feeds into people's attitude towards their emotional lives. So in other words, having accepted the case for self-denial in economic terms, people then come to suppress their deepest feelings because they feel that that too is something which the existing system demands of them. So Dickens was haunted by this idea that industrial capitalist Britain was reducing people to the level of kind of emotionally impoverished automatons who were becoming increasingly incapable of giving expression to their natural feelings of warmth and humanity and generosity and so on.
And the vulnerable populations in society, according to Dickens, also included children, right?
Absolutely, yes. Having made this general argument about the emotional impoverishment of people in capitalist society, what Dickens does, according to Jackson, is to emphasize that emotional self-denial is particularly hard on children, because for Dickens, children were naturally generous. They came into the world as gregarious, fun-loving creatures. And what was so terrible about capitalist culture for Dickens was that in order to tame children, it had to break their spirit at an early age. And as Jackson points out, one of the most fascinating recurring themes in Dickens's work is the way that the various systems of education, which existed in Britain in the 19th century, were all directed to this one goal of breaking the spirit of children and making them humble servants of the capitalist order. So if you look, for instance, at the character of Wackford Squeers in Nicholas Nickleby, he relies on physical violence as a means of taming children. He believes that the best way of ensuring that children slough off their natural generosity and compassion is to beat them. Someone like Miss Monflathers in the old curiosity shop, on the other hand, doesn't use physical violence, but she does imbue children with a sense of their own moral worthlessness. She tells them that they have come into the world as inherently sinful creatures and that their emotions are a byproduct of their sinfulness and therefore need to be suppressed. And somebody like Dr. Blimber, the famous Dr. Blimber in Dombey and Son, isn't so much reliant on violence. What he does do is try and stifle children by instilling a very repressive system of etiquette. So he tries to bring children up to be young ladies and young gentlemen. And in so doing, he stifles their natural tendency to be playful and life-loving and so on.
Philip Bounds is an historian, an author, a journalist, and a critic. His books include Notes from the End of History and British Communism and the Politics of Literature, 1928 to 1939. We were talking about an essay he contributed to the journal Socialism and Democracy about the British communist thinker and writer and activist and agitator and outsider, T.A. Jackson. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. What did Jackson argue was the social and class situation of Dickens himself?
Jackson tended to portray Dickens as a kind of outsider of the sort that he was himself. He portrayed Dickens as a kind of lower middle class radical intellectual who existed on the margins of the British progressive and labor movements. And it's precisely that marginality which conferred on Dickens the ability to analyze the trends of Victorian history so clearly. Here again, we see Jackson's preoccupation with outsiders coming through. What he's arguing is that Dickens was an outsider, and it was precisely his existence on the margin of things which made him such an acute social critic.
Yeah, and we don't have time to go into the details of this, but you write that Jackson represented Dickens as having a career in three stages. During the first stage, Dickens believed that the wealthy would effectively surrender their power and classes would dissolve imminently. So this is kind of an optimistic view that things will work themselves out toward greater equality and justice. And then stage two, Dickens felt that the ruling class, which had become hugely powerful, was not willing to give up power. It was full of pride, and so there was a certain pessimism, a strong pessimism to the second stage of Dickens's understanding. And then after 1848, can you tell us what Dickens believed, according to Jackson, about British institutions and their role in propagating inequality and the capacity, or I should say the willingness, of British institutions to actually address people's concerns?
Yes, there is an overall argument which ties this argument about the stages of Jackson's career together. I think it's important just to clarify what it is. Having argued that capitalist society inflicted emotional poverty on people, Dickens then went on to argue that although working people were subject to kinds of emotional repression, nevertheless, they retained a great deal more warmth and compassion than people from the middle and upper classes. So Jackson's solution to the problem, the cultural poverty of Victorian capitalism, was to argue that working people should be given more power. And he felt that the more power working people got, the likelier it was that their warmth and compassion would irradiate society as a whole and rescue it from the emotional poverty to which it had been reduced. And Jackson's argument is a very startling one. He says that because Dickens was a partisan of the working class movement, his career unfolds in a way which parallels the development of the working class movement. So as you say, in this first stage in his in his career, he was radiantly optimistic about the prospect of social reform because the Chartist movement in Britain, the movement which campaigned for working people to have the vote, was on the up. Then in the second stage, when Chartism is fading a little bit, he becomes more pessimistic and begins to realize that reform isn't as imminent as he thinks it is. But then in the third stage, which lasts in a sense between 1848 and his death in 1872, Dickens, in Jackson's opinion, becomes extremely pessimistic. Having believed in his early years that the British ruling class would willingly give up its power to working people, Jackson now comes to realize that, in fact, British institutions are specifically designed to exclude working people or prevent working people from exercising power. And this is a theme which he explores in particular with very great pessimism in the novel Bleak House, because as you know, Bleak House is organized around a court case between Jarndyce and Jarndyce, which takes place in London. And Dickens uses the English courts as a kind of metonym, if you like, for English institutions as a whole. And what he argues is that they are deliberately made very complex and very confusing, so that only a small group of initiates can rule them. And the court system in Bleak House becomes a symbol of the absolute determination of the English ruling class to exclude working people from power. And as I said earlier, Jackson didn't believe that Dickens was a communist, but what he did argue was that towards the end of his life, he adopted certain kind of proto-communist positions, and that had he lived longer, he might well have gone over to an out-and-out anti-capitalist communist position, simply because he had come to realize which the British society he had once been quite optimistic about was in fact a thoroughgoing autocracy whose purpose was to ensure the rule of the rich and the exclusion of ordinary people.
That's Philip Bounds. And in fact, he, in his essay in the journal Socialism and Democracy, the July 2017 issue, also brings up George Orwell on Jackson, on Dickens. In other words, Orwell had many things to say about T.A. Jackson's interpretation of Dickens's work and Jackson's understanding of Dickens's political thinking. We don't have time to go into that, but that's a fascinating part of Philip's essay that you may want to investigate for yourself by picking up this journal. Let's move on to Shakespeare, because you also look to Jackson's critical writings on Shakespeare. In this case, it's not a book, as it was with Dickens, but it's an essay that Jackson wrote on Shakespeare. What did Jackson say about Shakespeare's class position and social status?
Yes, Jackson's essay on Shakespeare was called Marx and Shakespeare, and it appeared in the Soviet journal International Literature in 1936. I said earlier that Jackson had conceived of himself as a kind of mediator in the British labor movement. As an outsider, he felt that he could mediate between different factions in the movement. And what he does in the essay on Shakespeare is to portray Shakespeare in similar terms. For him, Shakespeare was something of a social outsider who mediated between different factions of the ruling class, and in so doing was able to illuminate the relationship between them. I mean, Shakespeare was born into a middle-class family. So far as we know, he received a very good grammar school education. But then he decided to move from Stratford to London and to take his chances as a kind of penniless actor and writer in the London theatrical scene. So there was a sense in which Shakespeare made himself an outsider by virtue of his decision to turn his back on his relatively comfortable bourgeois origins and to plunge into the risky world of the London theatre. And Jackson's argument is that, again, Shakespeare acquired a kind of skeptical distance as a consequence of being outside the dominant groups. And this ties in with Jackson's analysis of what was going on in Elizabethan and Jacobean England at the time when Shakespeare was writing, because Jackson's argument is quite a complex one. He says that what happens in Shakespeare's time is that the emergent bourgeoisie, the middle-class people who were laying the foundations of the capitalist system in Britain, entered into a kind of alliance with the old aristocracy who ran the state, so that there wasn't so much an antagonism between the bourgeoisie and the aristocracy as an alliance of sorts. And what Jackson is arguing is that capitalism is an inherently unstable system. It's characterized by competition and instability and crisis and so on. And what the bourgeoisie was seeking to do in entering into an alliance with the absolutist state, the state of Elizabeth I and so on, was to ensure that capitalism could be stabilized by the actions of a strong state. And Jackson's argument is that Shakespeare had a very acute understanding of that alliance by virtue of the fact that he was positioned, as it were, halfway between the bourgeoisie and the state, and was able to understand the motives of both sides and to see the ways in which their conflicting attitudes could be made to harmonize in an alliance which stabilized capitalism in the early decades of its existence.
How did Jackson see Shakespeare as weighing in on capitalism in his plays?
Shakespeare's attitude, Shakespeare's evolution is an uneven one, because I think most Shakespeare scholars would now acknowledge that Shakespeare's work changes dramatically after about 1600. The plays he produces in the 1590s, some of the comedies, some of the history plays, tend to be rather optimistic. But then after 1600, suddenly there is this tremendous eruption of pessimism into Shakespeare's work, which expresses itself in tragedies like King Lear and Hamlet and Othello. And what Jackson is arguing, or at least implying, is that this shift from optimism to pessimism in Shakespeare's work reflects the shifting nature of the alliance between the bourgeoisie and the absolutist state. What happens at about 1600, Jackson argues, is that the alliance begins to break down. Whatever stability the bourgeoisie had been able to establish in alliance with the aristocracy now comes to an end, and Britain is plunged back into a period of social crisis, which of course would culminate in the Civil War later in the century. So what Jackson is arguing is that the breakdown of the alliance, which Shakespeare understood so well, led to an enormous amount of social instability, which Shakespeare reflected in the tremendous bleakness and pessimism of his later plays.
Philip Bounds, his books include Orwell and Marxism, and British Communism and the Politics of Literature, 1928 to 1939. And again, my guest, an historian and critic and journalist, contributed an article about the British communist thinker, writer, and agitator T.A. Jackson to the July 2017 issue of the journal Socialism and Democracy. Philip, thanks so much for your work and for joining us today.
Thank you, C.S.
And this is C.S., suggesting the important thing is not to stop questioning, and we hope you'll join us next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. You can visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio, resources, and more. You can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio, and you can follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.